Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, we have a soft spot on American Variety for adventurers and explorers, and also for people who pursue discovery and search for solutions to problems or mysteries. So our show today is something that combines both of those things. My guest is Rick Gillespie, who's the executive director of something called TIGHAR, which is T-I-G-H-A-R. It's an acronym that stands for the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery. One of the enduring mysteries of the 20th century was what happened to famed aviator Amelia Earhart and her navigator Fred Noonan on their around-the-world flight attempt. She disappeared on July 2, 1937, and there was a massive air and sea search that went on for 16 days. This was like a big deal. I mean, this was as big as the Lindbergh kidnapping or similar kinds of huge events, as big as the O.J. trial or something like that, right? So at $4 million, this search by the Navy and Coast Guard was the most costly and intensive search in U.S. history up to that time, right? But no sign at all was found of them or their aircraft. So that may not be surprising in the vast Pacific, but still, they had a rough idea of where she went down or was last heard from or where she should be, and they never found anything, not so much as a floating cushion or a piece of wreckage or anything. We had a guest on not too long ago who leads expeditions to recover downed World War II aircraft in the jungles of the South Pacific. And also, a World War II fighter plane recently appeared in the sands of a beach in Wales. And even today, aircraft are lost at sea or even over land and not found for years sometimes. So it's not surprising that out in the Pacific in the late 1930s that somebody would be lost and not found. And that was a time before radar and communications were primitive by today's standards. But anyway, these people just flat disappeared. So Rick, with TIGHAR, does aviation archaeology. Is that correct, Rick?
That's right.
And so he's joining us on the phone from Wilmington, Delaware. And TIGHAR has been trying for years, I guess it's fair to say that this is your primary project, really your main thrust is to try to find definitive evidence and solve the mystery of what happened to Amelia Earhart. And so Rick was a guest on the show a few years ago, and they've made a lot of progress since and might be very close to proving what happened to Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan. So Rick, if you wouldn't mind, just start off by telling us the basic background of Earhart's disappearance on that flight.
Sure, Court, and let me say it's a real pleasure to be back on the show.
Yeah, it's good to have you back.
Yeah. So it's 1937, and Amelia Earhart is going to try to set another flying record by being the first woman to fly around the world. She's going to do it as close as possible to the equator. Now, people had flown around the world quite a few times before that. That was nothing new. And as a matter of fact, Pan American Airways was flying scheduled passenger service across the Pacific, and a group of journalists had already flown around the world by commercial airline. But nobody had flown around the world at the equator, and no woman had certainly done it. So Earhart was going to do this. It was a publicity stunt. She and her husband, George Putnam, had a deal with the New York Herald Tribune syndicate of newspapers so that at every stop she would send back a travelogue story to the newspaper that would appear in the paper the next day. Actually telephone it in from most locations, believe it or not. That was possible in 37.
Wow.
So that was the motivation for the trip. And she started out, and her first attempt to fly around the world, she was going west. She took off from Oakland, California, and flew to Hawaii. The next step was to fly from Hawaii to a small island in the mid-Pacific called Howland Island, where the Bureau of Commerce had built a runway for her. But on the takeoff from Hawaii, she lost control of the airplane, wrecked it, and had to be repaired. So Amelia, being the determined person that she was, had the airplane repaired, raised additional money, and tried again, this time going the other direction, going east. She flew across the U.S., down into South America, across the South Atlantic to Africa, across the Indian subcontinent, down through Southeast Asia to Australia, and then ultimately to what is today Papua New Guinea. That was the territory of New Guinea. And from there, once more, she was to hop off, as they said in those days, to Howland Island in mid-Pacific. But this is a 2,500-mile-plus shot across open ocean. By far the most dangerous leg of the flight. Waiting for her at Howland Island was the U.S. Coast Guard cutter Itasca. Their job was to send her weather reports and put out radio signals that she was supposed to home in on to fine-tune the navigation for the final approach.
Yeah.
As she approached the island, they could hear her radio calls. She could not hear them. The radio direction finding didn't work because of a number of screw-ups on both Earhart's part and the Coast Guard's part. The bottom line is the airplane never arrived at Howland Island. It's got within probably 200 miles at least, but she was last heard from at just before 9 o'clock in the morning on July 2nd local time. Very loud on the radio, and she said she was following a navigational line. She didn't say, I'm going down, I'm out of fuel, mayday, mayday, anything like that. She just explained what she was doing to try to find the island, and then she never arrived. And the Navy mounted a massive search, as you mentioned, that found nothing. And the official verdict was that she simply got lost trying to find a tiny island in a big ocean and went down at sea, sank without a trace. The government did its best to find her, but never really stood a chance. Nobody did anything wrong, and isn't it a shame? So that's the way it stood on the 18th of July in 1937.
So there were many theories starting right off the bat and then over the years about what happened to her, and I guess the leading one is the obvious one, that she just went down at sea, ran out of gas, and went down, and that's called the crash and sink theory, which is, I guess, different from the crash and burn theory, but the second one would be that she crashed on an island somewhere or crash-landed somehow under some kind of control.
Well, actually, if there was a first one, the very first thing the Navy thought happened during the search was that she was on an island because, and this is an aspect of the story that's been largely forgotten, starting the night after she failed to arrive at Howland Island, and it was noontime, local time there, when everybody knew she had to be down someplace because her fuel would not last past noon.
Right.
So she's down somewhere. And that evening, a number of stations, both the Itasca, the ship, and stations around the Pacific, started to hear radio distress calls that appeared to be emanating from the aircraft. Now, at first they thought that the plane had to be floating around on the ocean sending radio calls, because with these massive empty fuel tanks, the airplane would float. But after these radio distress calls went on for several nights, Lockheed, the airplane manufacturer, said, hey, guys, you know, if you're hearing radio calls from this airplane, it's not in the water, because for the radio to work, it has to be dry. The airplane has to be not only on land, but it has to be on its wheels, relatively undamaged, able to run the right-hand generator-equipped engine to recharge the battery to send these signals. So your airplane is on land someplace, guys. And they started taking bearings on these distress calls. Pan American had these direction finder stations out there that they were using to guide their clippers across the northern Pacific. And the bearings generally cross in what is today and then called the Phoenix Group of Islands, specifically an island called Gardner Island, now known as Nicomororo. So the Navy says, look, we've got radio distress calls that are legitimate, that appear to be legitimate. The bearings are crossing near this island. The airplane has to be on land. She's got to be on one of these islands down here, probably that Gardner Island. So they send a battleship from Hawaii to check it out. Well, it's 2,000 miles. It takes a week to get there. When the planes from the battleship, they're just three catapult-launched float planes from the battleship, fly over Gardner Island, they do not see an airplane. But by then, the radio calls have stopped. And they see something on the ground that makes them think there's somebody down there. The phrase they used was clear signs of recent habitation.
Now, the island was thought to be uninhabited?
They thought that all these islands had native work parties harvesting coconuts. Oh. So they weren't terribly surprised to see some sign, whether it was footprints or a Lorenzville campfire, whatever it was.
Okay.
We don't know. But they saw something that made them think clear signs of recent habitation. So they made a lot of noise, circling and zooming, as they said, to get somebody to come out and wave to them. But they didn't see anybody. They didn't see an airplane. They concluded that nobody was there. They left not knowing that no one had been on that island. There had been no work party there since 1892, and then only for a short time. There should have been no sign of recent habitation.
Right.
They didn't know that. They, in their mind, they had searched for the airplane there. They didn't see anything. They crossed it off the list.
And if the plane had been on the island, they would have seen it or seen some sign of its landing. I mean, how big was the island? It's not a huge thing.
Well, the island is a classic South Seas atoll. It's a ribbon of land surrounding a beautiful lagoon. Hmm. The lagoon the island is shaped roughly in the shape of a human footprint, about 3.5 miles long, a mile across the widest part of the lagoon. Hmm. It's a good-sized island and densely vegetated, tall trees. There's a lot of territory there.
Yeah, but still, unless they were badly injured, they would have come out and waved frantically in the classic survivor of desert island
that's
survival.
That's an interesting point. We had an interesting opportunity in 2001. While we were there, a helicopter showed up. Now, this place is a million miles from nowhere. I mean, it's way out of the range of any helicopter. But a helicopter showed up. It was a small helicopter used by a tuna fishing boat to spot fish. And they were kind enough to give us a ride around the island so we could get some aerial footage and so forth with our camera. And one thing we discovered is that it's really hard to see people on the ground from even 100 feet in the air. And these Navy flyers maintained an altitude of at least 400 feet to avoid running into the seabirds that are all over the place out there.
Yeah.
And if somebody is out on the edge of the beach, it's really hard to spot them. And even if they're waving to you, the background is waving in the trade winds, so there's no relative motion. The trees are taller than they appear to be. You don't have any perspective. So what looks like maybe a 30 or 40 foot tree is more like 70 or 80 feet. So people are actually smaller than you expect them to be. So you can really see it in the video. If you don't freeze frame the video, you don't know somebody's down there. You have to point out, see right there, that's a person. It's quite amazing.
Boy, you can imagine the frustration if they had been down there waving frantically at these planes and not being seen, and then the plane disappears.
So not being seen and see these airplanes fly off over the horizon, they looked here and they didn't see it, so they're not going to look again.
Oh, my goodness.
And that's exactly what happened. They didn't look again.
Mm.
The place was crossed off. Oh, and because they didn't see an airplane on any of these islands, airplane or people, they then reasoned that, if those radio distress calls were legitimate, we should have seen them because they had to come from land. So, therefore, these radio signals must have been bogus, must have been hoaxes or misunderstandings. That's how the logic went.
Or other planes that were looking for her and, misheard communications from other aircraft on the same frequencies, that kind of thing. But
So the next thing that happened out there, so the one theory gets blown during the search, and then when the search doesn't find anything and all the ships are on their way home, the conclusion is, she just crashed at sea.
Okay. So then after that, when there was no sign of wreckage and basically everything came up zero, other theories started to emerge based on kind of vague reports, secondhand sightings and this kind of thing, and one I read about that was a kind of a military conspiracy that she had been sent by the U.S. government on a spy flight to overfly parts of Japanese territory and report on their military installations.
That was a huge thing, right up through the 1960s. And interestingly enough, it was both current events and Hollywood that were responsible for that. There was a film made and released in 1943 called Flight for Freedom. It was a fictional story about a famous woman flyer and her navigator, very thinly disguised, Amelia Earhart, obviously.
Yeah.
And they're going to fly around the world, and then the Navy approaches them and says, yes, but we need for you to photograph the Japanese installations in the Marshall Islands because we think there's something bad going on there. And the Japanese find out about it, so she actually crashes the airplane into the ocean to give the Navy an excuse to search the islands. Well, the film was very popular with troops overseas. So when the Marines went ashore on Saipan in 1944, they were already looking for Amelia Earhart. They'd seen the film. And, of course, the locals were more than happy to tell their liberators whatever they thought they wanted to hear.
Yeah, okay.
So all kinds of stories about
But even
an
specific
American
things.
Woman, American man being captured by the Japanese.
Even a specific thing like a woman saying that her father had been a Japanese policeman who was involved in the firing squad that executed her. And, very specific things. But those things can be, made up or told by someone to someone and inflated or mistranslated later and that kind of thing.
The trouble is that without hard evidence, either an original document, a photograph, or an artifact, all you have are stories. And the stories don't even support each other. The stories all contradict each other. She was executed by firing squad. She was executed by sword. She died of dysentery. She went back to Japan and became Tokyo Rose.
Yeah.
She was repatriated after the war and given a new identity under some kind of proto-witness protection program and lived out her life as Irene Bolam, a New Jersey housewife. I'm not making this stuff up.
Yeah.
I mean, it is as crazy as you want to get.
Right. Well, mysteries generate conspiracy theories.
We
see that all the time with a lot of things in our time. So
yeah.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis, and we're talking with Rick Gillespie, who's the executive director of something called TIGER, which is the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery, about their long-term search for the whereabouts of Amelia Earhart. They're trying to pursue that story and solve the mystery. And have gotten a long way toward it. Rick, I guess you could call it phase two of the crashed on an island theory. Began with the discovery in 1940, just a short while later, really, of some bones on that very island you were talking about. So why don't you just give us the thumbnail version of what happened with
sure.
that and how it led then to your search much later on.
Yeah. You might say that Amelia Earhart has been found several times. They just didn't know it.
Yeah, okay.
So the island had been uninhabited in 1937. In 1939, the British got around to putting a small colony work party on the island to start clearing land, establish a village, plant coconuts, and so forth. And in the spring of 1940, a work party on a remote end of the island, this is a remote island in the first place, so this is a remote end of a remote island, comes across a human skull, and they bury it, because if you're a Gilbertese worker, that's what you do. Otherwise, you have ghost problems.
Hmm.
So they bury the skull. And when the first British resident colonial officer showed up on the island a few months later, September of 1940, he hears this story about a skull being found. And he said, well, there'd be more bones if there was a skull. Let's go look. So he goes there, and he pokes around in the bushes. And sure enough, there is a partial skeleton there, with some artifacts, objects. There were parts of a woman's shoe. There was parts of a man's shoe. There was a box that had once contained a nautical sextant. There were some corks, some brass chains. There were campfires. There were dead birds, dead turtle. Obviously, this was a castaway who had tried to survive and died. And the bones that were missing were presumed to have been carried off by giant coconut crabs that live on the island.
Hmm.
And they are giant, and they do chew things up. I can testify to that. But very few people knew about this discovery. He thought he'd found Amelia Earhart. Okay, we have a woman's shoe, a castaway. Gosh, you know, that she's the only person missing out here. And so he reported this to his superiors, the British High Commission back in Fiji, 1,000 miles away, and they said, well, you box all that stuff up and send it to us and keep your mouth shut. They didn't want to get the Americans involved. It's 1940, summer of 40, Battle of Britain's going on. Things are a wee bit dicey for the British. And they don't want to go crying wolf to the Americans about finding their famous lost aviator.
Hmm.
So the bones arrive in Fiji, and objects, artifacts, arrive in Fiji in the spring of 41. A British Colonial Service doctor looks at the bones, takes some measurements, applies the formulas that are available to him at the time, and decides that the bones are the bones of a short, stocky European man. Well, that's not Amelia Earhart. And the sextant box is the wrong kind of sextant to be used in aviation. It's a nautical. It was a box for a nautical sextant, not an aviation octant. Well, we're not going to say anything to the Americans. So the whole file was closed. And the whole incident existed only as a rumor that very few people believed until we stumbled across the original paperwork in an obscure archive in 1997. And that, if there was a turning point in the project for us, I think it was that moment when we knew that, yes, the bones of a castaway had been found on the island. We have since been able to determine the measurements of the bones. We still don't have the bones. They have apparently been lost. But the measurements the doctor took, according to modern analysis, suggest that the person was a white female of Northern European descent who stood roughly her heart's height.
Oh, my gosh.
There's nobody else missing out there.
Yeah, if they can only find those bones. So really, the rest of the story has been your search for additional artifacts or remains that can be tied directly and conclusively to Earhart. So Tiger makes expeditions out to what is now called, what is it, Nicomororo?
Anyway, Nicomororo, that's
yeah,
correct.
The little island in the South Pacific periodically to try to solve this mystery. How many trips have you made so far, Rick?
10.
Wow. When did you start? What year?
We started in 1989. And our most recent trip was last year, May and June of last year. And with each trip, we've been able to focus in more and more on what happened. You know, an investigation is not an event, it's a process. And we have been successful in locating this spot on the island where the bones were found, where the castaway campsite was. Hmm. And we've done archaeological excavations at that site in 2001, 2007, and last year. And that site is producing artifacts that speak of an American woman of the 1930s.
So what kinds of things have you found?
A woman's compact, but both a broken mirror and bits of what tests out chemically as fragments of early 20th century makeup, cosmetic.
Wow.
A zipper, American zipper, Talon zipper, made in Meadville, Pennsylvania. We can date it based on the markings and the design to between 1933 and 1936. This was never marketed to the military. So we have a jackknife of the same description as one that's listed in the inventory of the Earhart aircraft that was made after the wreck in Hawaii. We have a number of bottles of small personal care products, small quantity. The bottles are datable with the embossed imprints on them to 1933.
Oh, my gosh.
St. Joseph's family liniment, men and baby oil, or possibly a bottle of skin bracer. The neatest one is a little thing called an ointment pot. Kind of an elegant little container that appears to have contained Dr. Barry's freckle cream. This was an ointment that women used to fade. It'll also work on tans, but it would fade freckles, basically bleach the skin. It was terrible stuff. It was 18% mercury.
Oh, my gosh.
But we find these things here that are entirely consistent with this castaway. And
of that date, yeah.
Of that date.
And so,
we have a number of fire features with 2,000 bird bones, 1,900 fish bones, hundreds of clamshells, which we've had examined by anthropologists that confirm that this appears to be a Westerner who's catching anything they can get and preparing it the way Westerners prepare things. This is not Pacific Islanders. This is a castaway's campsite of a Western castaway who appears to have been female.
So have you found any more bones that appear to be human apart from the turtle and bird bones?
I gather that's
a big question.
We have some possibilities that are being investigated as we speak, and that's really all I can say about it.
Okay. What about any other biological remains?
Yeah. Odd thing. We found what appears to be very dried fecal matter is the polite way to describe it. And this is being tested. All of our DNA work is now being done by the University of Oklahoma Molecular Anthropology Laboratories in Norman, Oklahoma. And we're continuing to do work with fecal material. We already know there's human DNA there. What we're looking for and hoping for is to get enough DNA to compare to the Earhart family sample we have from an Earhart family member. So now that jury is still out.
Well, I hope the university is doing it pro bono or at least at a discounted rate because that stuff's expensive.
They do as much as they can, but all of this analytical work costs tens of thousands of dollars.
Sure, that's why I say that. Yeah. So, well, it sounds like you have enough what we could call circumstantial evidence that many people would be convinced of it, but you still need scientifically conclusive evidence. So what do you currently believe? Are you sure you've got the right site, or is it still a question mark in your mind?
What we have are multiple lines of investigation that all point to the same conclusion with no contradicting evidence. So, yeah, this is where it happened. What we don't have is something simple that the public can get their heads around.
Yeah,
and that's going to be either a DNA match or the actual wreckage of the airplane, which we think is in the water off the western end of the island where it was washed into the sea by surf and tide. So our objective now, we've got still lots of analysis coming in, but we need to get out there and search the deep water for that airplane wreckage, and that's very expensive. And so the challenge, as it always is to raise enough money to be able to do that.
Sure. Well, you had mentioned the possibility of the plane, but that would have been seen by the overflights shortly afterward, you would think. But isn't there a theory that there's a flat, shallow reef right off the island that the plane could have landed on that?
We know there is a reef that extends out from the shoreline about 700 feet.
Mm-hmm.
It's flat out near the ocean, absolutely landable. That appears to be where the airplane was landed and sent radio distress calls for several nights. But rising tides and surf probably washed the airplane over the edge of the reef into the deep water. We actually have a photograph that was taken 3 months of that end of the island. It was taken 3 months after Earhart disappeared by a British expedition. They weren't looking for her. They were checking the place out for future settlement. That shows something sticking out of the water in a place where there shouldn't be. We are looking into the possibility that we have a photograph of part of the wreckage of the plane.
Wow.
On the reef, 3 months after she disappeared. There's a tremendous amount of evidence supporting the hypothesis that this is where it happened. And what we still need is that smoking gun, whether it comes from DNA or an identifiable part of airplane wreckage, and it'll come. I'm absolutely convinced that it'll come.
When are you going back next?
When we can raise the money. Yeah, that's always the hard part. And
how many people go on these expeditions?
When we're doing work on land, we can take a team of about 15 people. Some are volunteers, some are what we call sponsor team members that help pay for the expedition. For the deep water search, we don't need a bunch of labor. You know, that's basically a contract job. But there is more work to be done on land, so there will be more land expeditions, and we will need more volunteers and sponsors.
So people can contact you if they're interested in going as paying volunteers and sponsors?
Yeah, we have an extensive website, and we're always looking for it. We're a membership organization. We encourage people to join, help support the work, and, of course, people who are interested in going on expeditions can take our field school. We just completed this year's field school in aviation archaeology. Yeah, this is all about the people finding Amelia. The government couldn't do it. The people will find Amelia.
Tigar's website is www.tighar.org, tigar.org, tighar.org. So you can log on there and find out a lot more about this fascinating project and maybe sign on to help. I saw that a senior curator at the National Air and Space Museum, Rick, said, "The mystery part of this is what keeps us interested. In part, we remember Earhart because she's our favorite missing person." And if you can solve the mystery, you'll get more than your 15 minutes of fame, I think. So,
I'm not looking for the fame.
No, I know.
We're looking for the satisfaction of knowing the truth.
It'd be neat to know and neat to find. But thanks so much for being on with us on American Variety.
Always my pleasure.
And thanks to you all for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.